year, and more than 1 million die. Of course, malaria is not a disease that we're particularly sensitive to in the developed world, since it was eradicated in North America and Europe 50 years ago. Tanzanian researcher Wen Kalama once famously pointed out that if seven Boeing 747s, mostly filled with children, crashed into Mount Kilimanjaro every day, then the world would take notice. That is the scale on which malaria kills its victims. Harvard economist Jeffrey Sachs has estimated that sub-Saharan Africa would be almost a third richer today if malaria had been eradicated in 1965. Now back to DDT, which is the most cost-effective way of controlling the mosquitoes that spread the disease. The next best alternative is not only less effective, but also 4 times as expensive. Do the health benefits of DDT justify its environmental costs? Yes, argue some groups, like the Sierra Club, the Endangered Wildlife Trust, Environmental Defense Fund, and the World Health Organization. Yes, you read those names correctly. They have all embraced DDT as a useful poison for fighting malaria in poor countries. When the United Nations convened representatives from 120 countries in South Africa in 2000 to ban persistent organic pollutants, the delegates agreed to exempt DDT in situations where it's being used to fight malaria. Meanwhile, not all regulations are created equal. The relevant question is not always whether or not government should involve itself in the economy. The more important issue may be how the subsequent regulation is structured. University of Chicago economist and Nobel laureate Gary Becker spends his summers on Cape Cod, where he's a fond consumer of striped bass. Because the stocks of this fish are dwindling, the government has imposed a limit on the total commercial catch of striped bass allowed every season. Mr. Becker has no problem with that. He'd like to be able to eat striped bass 10 years from now, too. Instead, he raised the issue in a column for Business Week about how the government chose to limit the total catch. At the time he was writing, the government had imposed an aggregate quota on the quantity of striped bass that could be harvested every season. Mr. Becker wrote, "Unfortunately, this is a very poor way to control fishing because it encourages each fishing boat to carry as much as it can early in the season before other boats bring in enough fish to reach the aggregate quota that applies to all of them. Everybody loses. The fishermen get low prices for their fish when they sell into a glut early in the season. Then, after the aggregate quota is reached early in the season, consumers are unable to get any striped bass at all. Several years later, Massachusetts did change its system so that the striped bass quota is divided among individual fishermen. The total catch is still limited, but individual fishermen can fulfill their quota any time during the season. The key to thinking like an economist is recognizing the trade-offs inherent to fiddling with markets. Regulation can disrupt the movement of capital and labor, raise the cost of goods and services, inhibit innovation, and otherwise shackle the economy, such as by letting mosquitoes escape alive. And that is just the regulation inspired by good intentions. At worst, regulation can become a powerful tool for self-interest as firms work the political system to their own benefit. After all, if you can't beat your competitors, then why not have the government hobble them for you? University of Chicago economist George Stigler won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1982 for his trenchant observation and supporting evidence that firms and professional associations often seek regulation as a way of advancing their own interests. Consider a regulatory campaign that took place in my home state of Illinois. The state legislature was being pressured to enact more stringent licensing requirements for manicurists. Was this a grassroots lobbying campaign being waged by the victims of pedicures gone terribly awry? One can just imagine them limping in pain up the Capitol steps. Not exactly. The lobbying was being done by the Illinois Cosmetology Association, on behalf of established spas and salons that would rather not compete with a slew of immigrant upstarts. The number of nail salons grew 23% in just 1 year in the late 1990s, with discount salons offering manicures for as little as $6, compared to $25 in a full-service salon. Stricter licensing requirements, which almost always exempt existing service providers, would have limited this fierce competition by making it more expensive to open a new salon. Milton Friedman has pointed out that the same thing happened on a wider scale in the 1930s. After Hitler came to power in 1933, large numbers of professionals fled Germany and Austria for the United States. In response, many professions erected barriers, such as good citizenship requirements and language exams that had a tenuous connection to the quality of service provided. Friedman pointed out that the number of foreign-trained physicians licensed to practice in the United States in the 5 years after 1933 was the same as in the 5 years before, which would have been highly unlikely if licensing requirements existed only to screen out incompetent doctors, but quite likely if the licensing requirements were used to ration the number of foreign doctors allowed into the profession. By global standards, the United States has a relatively lightly regulated economy, though try making that argument at a Chamber of Commerce meeting. Indeed, one sad irony of the developing world is that governments fail in their most basic tasks, such as defining property rights and enforcing the law, while piling on other kinds of heavy-handed regulation. In theory, this kind of regulation could protect consumers from fraud, improve public health, or safeguard the environment. On the other hand, economists have asked whether this kind of regulation is less of a helping hand for society and more of a grabbing hand for corrupt bureaucrats whose opportunities to extort bribes rise along with the number of government permits and licenses required for any endeavor. A group of economists studied the helping hand versus grabbing hand question by examining the procedures, costs, and expected delays associated with starting up a new business in 75 different countries. The range was extraordinary. Registering and licensing a business in Canada requires a mere 2 procedures compared to 20 in Bolivia. The time required to open a new business legally ranges from 2 days, again in Canada, to 6 months in Mozambique. The cost of jumping through these assorted government hoops ranges from 0.4% of per capita GDP in New Zealand to 260% of per capita GDP in Bolivia. The study found that in poor countries like Vietnam, Mozambique, Egypt, and Bolivia, an entrepreneur has to give up an equal amount to 1 to 2 times his annual salary, not counting bribes and the opportunity cost of his time, just to get a new business licensed. So are consumers safer and healthier in countries like Mozambique than they are in Canada or New Zealand? No. The authors find that compliance with international quality standards is lower in countries with more regulation. Nor does this government red tape appear to reduce pollution or raise health levels. Meanwhile, excessive regulation pushes entrepreneurs into the underground economy, where there is no regulation at all. It's hardest to open a new business in countries where corruption is highest, suggesting that excessive regulation is a potential source of income for the bureaucrats who enforce it. India has over 1 billion people, many of whom are desperately poor. Education has clearly played a role in moving the nation's economy forward and lifting millions of citizens out of poverty. Higher education, in particular, has contributed to the creation and expansion of a vibrant information technology sector. However, a recent shortage of skilled workers has been a drag on economic growth. So it's no great economic conundrum as to why a pharmaceutical college in Mumbai would seek to use empty space in its 8-story building to double student enrollment. The problem is that this action turned the college administration into criminals. It's true. The Indian government imposes strict regulations on its technical colleges that protect against something as reckless and potentially dangerous as using empty space to educate more students. Specifically, the law stipulates that a technical college must provide 168 square feet of building space for each student to ensure adequate space for learning. That formula precludes the principal K.M. Kudnani College of Pharmacy from teaching more than 300 students, regardless of the fact that all the lecture halls on the top floor of the building are padlocked for lack of use. According to the Wall Street Journal, the rules also stipulate the exact size for libraries and administrative offices, the ratio of professors to assistant professors and lecturers, quotas for student enrollment, and the number of computer terminals, books, and journals that must be on site. Thankfully, governments sometimes roll back these kinds of regulation. In November 2008, the European Union acted boldly to legalize ugly fruits and vegetables. Prior to that time, supermarkets across Europe were forbidden from selling overly curved, extra knobbly, or oddly shaped produce. This was a true act of political courage by European Union authorities, given that representatives from 16 of the 27 member nations tried to block the deregulation while it was being considered by the EU Agricultural Management Committee. I wish I were making this stuff up. Let's step out of our cynical mode for a moment and return to the idea that government has the capacity to do many good things. Even then, when government is doing the things that it is theoretically supposed to do, government spending must be financed by levying taxes, and taxes exert a cost on the economy. This fiscal drag, as Burton Malkiel has called it, stems from two things. First, taxes take money out of our pockets, which necessarily diminishes our purchasing power and therefore our utility. True, the government can create jobs by spending billions of dollars on jet fighters, but we're paying for those jets with money from our paychecks, which means that we buy fewer televisions, we give less to charity, we take fewer vacations. Thus, government is not necessarily creating jobs. It may be simply moving them around, or on net, destroying them. This effect of taxation is less obvious than the new defense plant at which happy workers churn out shiny airplanes. When we turn to macroeconomics later in the book, we'll examine the Keynesian premise that government can increase economic growth by stoking the economy during economic downturns. Second, and more subtly, taxation causes individuals to change their behavior in ways that make the economy worse off without necessarily providing any revenue for the government. Think about the income tax, which can be as high as 50 cents for every dollar earned by the time all the relevant state and federal taxes are tallied up. Some individuals, who'd prefer to work if they were taking home every dollar they earn, may decide to leave the labor force when the marginal tax rate is 50%. Everybody loses in this situation. Someone whose preference is to work quits his or her job, or does not start working in the first place, yet the government raises no revenue. As we noted in Chapter 2, economists refer to this kind of inefficiency associated with taxation as deadweight loss. It makes you worse off without making anyone else better off. Imagine that a burglar breaks into your home and steals assorted personal possessions. In his haste, he makes off with wads of cash, but also a treasured family photo album. There is no deadweight loss associated with the cash he's stolen. Every dollar purloined from you makes him better off by a dollar. Perversely, it's simply a transfer of wealth in the eyes of our amoral economists. On the other hand, the stolen photo album is pure deadweight loss. It means nothing to the thief, who tosses it in a dumpster when he realizes what he's taken. Yet, it's a tremendous loss to you. Any kind of taxation that discourages productive behavior causes some deadweight loss. Taxes can discourage investment, too. An entrepreneur who's considering making a risky investment may do so when the expected return is $100 million, but not when the expected return, diminished by taxation, is only $60 million. An individual may pursue a graduate degree that will raise her income by 10%. But that same investment, which is costly in terms of tuition and time, may not be worthwhile if her after-tax income, what she actually sees after all those deductions on the paycheck, only goes up 5%. On the day my younger brother got his first paycheck, he came home, opened the envelope, and then yelled, "Who the hell is FICA?" Or consider a family that has a spare $1,000 and is deciding between buying a big-screen television and squirreling the money away in an investment fund. These two options have profoundly different impacts on the economy in the long run. Choosing the investment makes capital available to firms that build plants, conduct research, train workers. These investments are the macro equivalents of a college education. They make us more productive in the long run and therefore richer. Buying the television, on the other hand, is current consumption. It makes us happy today, but does nothing to make us richer tomorrow. Yes, money spent on a television keeps workers employed at the television factory, but if the same money were invested, it would create jobs somewhere else, say for scientists in a laboratory, or workers on a construction site, while also making us richer in the long run. Think about the college example. Sending students to college creates jobs for professors. Using the same money to buy fancy sports cars for high school graduates would create jobs for auto workers. The crucial difference between these scenarios is that a college education makes a young person more productive for the rest of his or her life. A sports car does not. Thus, college tuition is an investment. Buying a sports car is consumption, though buying a car for work or business might be considered an investment. So back to our family with a spare $1,000. What will they choose to do with it? Their decision will depend on the after-tax return the family can expect to earn by investing the money rather than spending it. The higher the tax, such as a capital gains tax, the lower the return on the investment, and therefore the more attractive the television becomes. Taxation discourages both work and investment. Many economists argue that cutting taxes and rolling back regulation unleashes productive forces in the economy. This is true. The most ardent supply-siders argue further that tax cuts can actually raise the amount of revenue collected by the government because we all will work harder, earn higher incomes, and end up paying more in taxes even though tax rates have fallen. This is the idea behind the Laffer curve, which provided the intellectual underpinnings for the large Reagan-era tax cuts. Economist Arthur Laffer theorized in 1974 that high tax rates discourage so much work and investment that cutting taxes will earn the government more revenue, not less. He first sketched a graph of this idea on a restaurant napkin while having dinner with a group of journalists and politicians. In one of life's delicious ironies, it was Dick Cheney's napkin. At some level of taxation, this relationship must be true. If the personal income tax is 95%, for example, then no one is going to do a whole lot of work beyond what is necessary to subsist. Cutting the tax rate to 50% would almost certainly boost government revenues. But would the same relationship hold true in the United States, where tax rates were much lower to begin with? Both the Reagan tax cuts and the George W. Bush tax cuts provided an answer: no. These large tax cuts did not boost government revenues, relative to what they would have been in the absence of the tax cut. They led to large budget deficits. There's a subtle but important analytical point here. Those who argue that tax cuts increase government revenues often point out, correctly, that government revenues are higher after a major tax cut than before. But this is not the appropriate comparison to make. The question we should ask is whether government revenues after the tax cut are higher than they would have been if there had not been a tax cut. The reason this distinction matters is that inflation and economic growth push government revenues higher year after year, even when the tax rate is unchanged. So, it's entirely plausible that revenues would have climbed 5% without the tax cut. If they climb 2% with the tax cut, government revenues are indeed higher than the year before, but lower than they would have been without the tax cut. If spending growth is not curtailed to match this new revenue reality, then budget deficits will result, which is usually what happens. In the case of the Reagan tax cuts, Mr. Laffer's conjecture did appear to hold true for the wealthiest Americans, who ended up sending more money to the Treasury after their tax rates were cut. Of course, this may be mere coincidence. As we shall explore in Chapter 6, highly skilled workers saw their wages rise sharply over the last several decades as the economy increasingly demanded more brains than brawn. Thus, the wealthiest Americans may have paid more in taxes because their incomes went up sharply, not because they were working harder in response to lower tax rates. In the United States, where tax rates are low relative to the rest of the world, supply-side economics is a chimera. In all but unique circumstances, we cannot cut taxes and have more money to spend on government programs, a point that conservative economists readily concede. Bruce Bartlett, an official in both the Reagan and the George H.W. Bush administrations, has publicly lamented that the term supply-side economics has morphed from an important and defensible idea that lower marginal tax rates stimulate economic activity into the implausible notion that all tax cuts raise revenue. When Senator John McCain told the National Review in 2007 that tax cuts, as we all know, increase revenues, Harvard economist Greg Mankiw, who served as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers for George W. Bush, posed a logical follow-up question on his blog. If you think tax cuts increase revenue, why advocate spending restraint? Can't we pay for new spending programs with more tax cuts? If I sound rather emphatic in making this point, I am. The problem with the tax cuts increase revenue fallacy is that it confuses the debate over our public finances by giving the illusion that we can get something for nothing. You should recognize by now that this is not usually the case in economics. There are a lot of good things about tax cuts. They leave more money in our pockets. They stimulate hard work and risk-taking. In fact, the increased economic activity caused by lower tax rates usually does help to make up for some of the lost revenue. $1 in tax cuts may only cost the government 80 cents in lost revenue, or 50 cents in extreme cases, as government is taking a smaller slice of a bigger pie. Think about a simple numerical example. Suppose the tax rate is 50% and the tax base is $100 million. Tax revenues would be $50 million. Now, suppose that the tax rate is cut to 40%. Some people work extra hours now that they get to keep more of their earnings. A few spouses take second jobs. Assume that the tax base grows to $110 million. Government revenue is now 40% of that bigger economy, or $44 million. Government has lost revenue by taking a smaller percentage of pre-existing economic activity. But some of that loss is offset by taking a percentage of the new economic activity. If there had been no economic response to the tax cut, the 10 percentage point cut in the tax rate would have cost the government $10 million in lost revenue. Instead, only $6 million is foregone. In the case of a tax increase, the same phenomenon is likely in reverse. The increase in new revenues will be offset in part by some shrinking of the economic pie. Tax experts typically take these behavioral responses into account when projecting the effects of a tax cut or a tax increase. In all but the most extraordinary of circumstances, there is no free lunch. Lower tax rates mean less total government revenue, and therefore fewer resources to fight wars, balance the budget, catch terrorists, educate children, or do anything else governments typically do. That's the trade-off. The bastardization of supply-side economics has taken an important intellectual debate. Whether we should pay more in taxes to get more in government services, or pay less and get less, and transformed it into an intellectually dishonest premise, that we can pay less and get more. I wish that were true, just as I wish that I could get rich by working less or lose weight by eating more. So far it hasn't happened. Having said all that, the proponents of smaller government have a point. Lower taxes can lead to more investment, which causes a faster long-term rate of economic growth. It's facile to dismiss this as a bad idea or a policy that strictly favors the rich. A growing pie is important, perhaps even most important, for those with the smallest slices. When the economy grows slowly or sinks into recession, it's steelworkers and busboys who are laid off, not brain surgeons and university professors. In 2009, in the midst of the recession induced by the financial crisis, the American poverty rate was more than 13%, the highest rate in more than a decade. Conversely, the 1990s were pretty good for those at the bottom of the economic ladder. Rebecca Blank, a University of Michigan economist and member of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Clinton administration, looked back on the remarkable economic expansion of the 1990s and noted, "I believe that the first and most important lesson for anti-poverty warriors from the 1990s is that sustained economic growth is a wonderful thing. To the extent that policies can help maintain strong employment growth, low unemployment, and expanding wages among workers, these policies may matter as much or more than the dollars spent on targeted programs for the poor. If there are no job opportunities, or if wages are falling, it is much more expensive, both in terms of dollars spent and political capital, for government programs alone to lift people out of poverty." So, for two chapters now, I've danced around the obvious Goldilocks question. Is the role the government plays in the United States economy too big, too small, or just about right? I can finally offer a simple, straightforward, and unequivocal answer. It depends on whom you ask. There are smart and thoughtful economists who would like to see a larger, more activist government. There are smart and thoughtful economists who'd prefer a smaller government. And there is a continuum of thinkers in between. In some cases, the experts disagree over factual questions, just as eminent surgeons may disagree over the appropriate remedy for opening a clogged artery. For example, there's an ongoing dispute over the effects of raising the minimum wage. Theory suggests that there must be a trade-off. A higher minimum wage obviously helps those workers whose wages are raised. At the same time, it hurts some low-wage workers who lose their jobs or never get hired in the first place because firms cut back on the number of workers they employ at the new higher wage. Economists disagree, and present competing research over how many jobs are lost when the minimum wage goes up. This is a crucial piece of information if one's to make an informed decision on whether or not raising the minimum wage is a good policy for helping low-wage workers. Over time, it's a question that can be answered with good data and solid research. As one policy analyst once pointed out to me, it may be easy to lie with statistics, but it's a lot easier to lie without them. More often, economics can merely frame issues that require judgments based on morals, philosophy, and politics, somewhat as a doctor lays out the options to a patient. The physician can outline the medical issues related to treating an advanced cancer with chemotherapy. The treatment decision ultimately resides with the patient, who will interject his or her own views on quality of life versus longevity, willingness to experience discomfort, family situation, etc., all perfectly legitimate considerations that have nothing to do with medicine or science. Yet making that decision still requires excellent medical advice. In that vein of thought, we can present a framework for thinking about the role of the government in the economy. Government has the potential to enhance the productive capacity of the economy and make us much better off as a result. Government creates and sustains the legal framework that makes markets possible. It raises our utility by providing public goods that we are unable to purchase for ourselves. It fixes the rough edges of capitalism by correcting externalities, particularly in the environmental realm. Thus, the notion that smaller government is always better government is simply wrong. That said, reasonable people can agree with everything above and still disagree over whether the U.S. government should be bigger or smaller. It's one thing to believe, in theory, that government has the capacity to spend resources in ways that'll make us better off. It's another to believe that the fallible politicians who make up Congress are going to choose to spend money that way. Is a German-Russian museum in Lawrence Welk's birthplace of Strasburg, North Dakota, really a public good? Congress allocated $500,000 for the museum in 1990, and then withdrew it in 1991 when there was a public outcry. How about a $100 million appropriation to search for extraterrestrial life? Searching for E.T. meets the definition of a public good, since it would be impractical for each of us to mount his or her own individual search for life in outer space. Still, I suspect that many Americans would prefer to see their money spent elsewhere. If I were to poll 100 economists, nearly every one of them would tell me that significantly improving primary and secondary education in this country would lead to large economic gains. But the same group would be divided over whether or not we should spend more money on public education. Why? Because they disagree sharply over whether pouring more money into the existing system would improve student outcomes. Some government activity shrinks the size of the pie, but still may be socially desirable. Transferring money from the rich to the poor is technically inefficient, in the sense that sending a check for $1 to a poor family may cost the economy $1.25 when the deadweight costs of taxation are taken into account. The relatively high taxation necessary to support a strong social safety net falls most heavily on those with productive assets, including human capital, making countries like France a good place to be a child born into a poor family and a bad place to be an internet entrepreneur, which in turn makes it a bad place to be a high-tech worker. Overall, policies that guarantee some pie for everybody will slow the growth of the pie itself. Per capita income in the United States is higher than per capita income in France. The United States also has a higher proportion of children living in poverty. Having said all that, reasonable people can disagree over the appropriate level of social spending. First, they may have different preferences about how much wealth they're willing to trade off for more equality. The United States is a richer but more unequal place than most of Europe. Second, the notion of a simple trade-off between wealth and equality oversimplifies the dilemma of helping the most disadvantaged. Economists who care deeply about the poorest Americans may disagree over whether the poor would be helped more by expensive government programs, such as universal health care, or by lower taxes that would encourage economic growth and put more low-income Americans to work at higher wages. Last, some government involvement in the economy is purely destructive. Heavy-handed government can be like a millstone around the neck of a market economy. Good intentions can lead to government programs and regulations whose benefits are grossly outweighed by their costs. Bad intentions can lead to all kinds of laws that serve special interests or corrupt politicians. This is especially true in the developing world, where much good could be done just by getting government out of areas of the economy where it does not belong. As Jerry Jordan, former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, has noted, "What separates the economic haves from the have-nots is whether the role of an economy's institutions, particularly its public institutions, is to facilitate production or to confiscate it. In short, government is like a surgeon's scalpel. It's an intrusive tool that can be used for good or for ill. Wielded carefully and judiciously, it will facilitate the body's remarkable ability to heal itself. In the wrong hands, or wielded overzealously, with even the best of intentions, it can cause great harm. Chapter 5. Economics of Information. McDonald's didn't create a better hamburger. When Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992, he floated the idea of HOPE scholarships. The Clinton plan, based on an earlier experiment at Yale, was seemingly elegant. Students could borrow money for college and then repay the loans after graduation with a percentage of their annual income, rather than the usual fixed payments of principal plus interest. Graduates who went on to become investment bankers would owe more in student loans than graduates who counseled disadvantaged teens in poor neighborhoods, which was exactly the point. The plan was designed to address the concerns that students graduating with large debts are forced to do well rather than do good. After all, it's hard to become a teacher or a social worker after graduating with $75,000 in student loans. In theory, the program would finance itself. Administrators could determine the average post-graduation salary for eligible students and then calculate the percentage of income they'd have to pay in order for the program to recoup its costs, say 1.5% of annual income for 15 years. Students who became brain surgeons would pay back more than the average. Students who fought tropical diseases in Togo would pay less. On average, the high and low earners would cancel each other out, and the program would break even. There was just one problem. The HOPE scholarships had no hope of working, at least not without a large, ongoing government subsidy. The problem was a crucial asymmetry of information. Students know more about their future career plans than loan administrators do. College students never know their future plans with certainty, but most have a good idea whether their post-graduation income will be more or less than average, which is enough to determine if a HOPE scholarship would be more or less expensive than a conventional loan. Aspiring Wall Street barons would avoid the program because it's a bad deal for them. Who wants to pay back 1.5% of $5 million every year for 15 years when a conventional loan would be much cheaper? Meanwhile, the world's future kindergarten teachers and Peace Corps volunteers would opt in. The result is called adverse selection. Future graduates sort themselves in or out of the program based on private information about their career plans. In the end, the program attracts predominantly low earners. The repayment calculations, based on the average post-graduation salary, no longer apply, and the program cannot recover its costs. One may assume that Mr. Clinton ignored what his advisors almost certainly told him about the Yale experiment. It was quietly canceled after 5 years, both because repayments fell short of projections and because the administrative costs were prohibitive. What we don't know can hurt us. Economists study how we acquire information, what we do with it, and how we make decisions when all we get to see is a book's cover. Indeed, the Swedish Academy of Sciences recognized this point in 2001 by awarding the Nobel Prize in Economics to George Akerlof, Michael Spence, and Joseph Stiglitz for their seminal work on the economics of information. Their work explores the problems that arise when rational people are forced to make decisions based on incomplete information, or when one party to a transaction knows more than another. Their insights are relevant to some of our most pressing social issues, from genetic screening to discrimination in the workplace. Consider a small law firm interviewing two job candidates, one male and one female. Both candidates are recent Harvard Law School graduates and are eminently qualified for the position. If the best candidate for the job is the one who will earn the most money for the firm, which seems a reasonable assumption, then I'll argue that the rational choice is to hire the man. The interviewer has no specific information on the family plans of the candidates at hand and is forbidden by law from asking about them, but can make a reasonable inference based on what everyone knows about America at the beginning of the 21st century. Women still bear the bulk of child-rearing responsibilities. Demographics suggest that both candidates are likely to start families in the near future. Yet only the female candidate will take paid maternity leave. More important, she may not return to work after having the child, which leaves the firm with the cost of finding, hiring, and training another lawyer. Is any of this certain? No. The male candidate may have dreams of staying home with his 5 children. The female candidate may have decided years ago that she has no interest in having children. But these are not the most likely scenarios. The female candidate is punished because the firm has no information on her specific circumstances, but good data on broad social trends. Is this fair? No. And it's not legal either. Yet the firm's logic makes sense. In other words, it's rational to discriminate in this case, which turns the whole idea of discrimination on its head. Discrimination is usually irrational. As Nobel laureate Gary Becker pointed out in The Economics of Discrimination, employers with a taste for discrimination sacrifice profits because they pass over minorities in favor of less qualified whites. A patient who refuses to see an eminent black doctor because of his skin color is a fool. A law firm that minimizes employee turnover by playing the statistical averages may offend our sensibilities and violate federal law, but it is not foolish. When we approach the situation as an information problem, there are several crucial insights. First, firms are not the only villains. When professional women choose to have a child, take paid maternity leave, and then quit their companies, they impose a cost, arguably unfair, on their firms. More important, they impose a cost on other women. Firms that feel they've been burned by employees who take maternity leave and then quit are more likely to discriminate against young women in the hiring process, particularly those who are already pregnant, and less likely to offer generous maternity benefits. The good news is that there's a quick and easy solution, a generous but refundable maternity package. Keep it if you come back to work, return it if you don't. That simple policy change gives us nearly everything we want. Firms no longer have to be concerned about paying benefits to women who will not return to work. Indeed, it becomes possible to offer more generous benefits without providing an incentive for workers to take the money and run. Women, in turn, do not face the same level of discrimination in the hiring process. Statistical discrimination, or so-called rational discrimination, takes place when an individual makes an inference that is defensible based on broad statistical patterns, but 1. Is likely to be wrong in the specific case at hand, and 2. Has a discriminatory effect on some group. Suppose an employer has no racial prejudice, but does have an aversion to hiring workers with a criminal background. That's certainly a reasonable preference, for all kinds of reasons. If this employer has to make a hiring decision without access to applicants' criminal backgrounds, either because he doesn't have the time or resources to gather such information, or perhaps because he's forbidden by law from asking, then it's entirely plausible that he will discriminate against black male applicants, who are far more likely to have served time in prison, 28%, than white male applicants, 4%. Of course, all this employer cares about is whether or not the person standing in front of him has a criminal record. If he can acquire that information with certainty, then the broader social patterns don't matter. In theory, We'd expect access to criminal background checks to reduce discrimination against black men without criminal records. In fact, that's what the data show us. A group of economists compared hiring decisions at firms that conduct criminal background checks with hiring decisions at firms that don't. They concluded, "We find that employers who check criminal backgrounds are more likely to hire African-American workers, especially men. This effect is stronger among those employers who report an aversion to hiring those with criminal records than among those who do not." With race, more information is usually better. The corresponding implication is that less information can be worse. The United States has a huge ex-offender population. America has a high incarceration rate, and most people who go to prison eventually get out. The median sentence is less than 2 years. Policies that seek to help ex-offenders by suppressing information on their criminal backgrounds may be bad for a much wider population. The authors of the study cited above warn that their results suggest that curtailing access to criminal history records may actually harm more people than it helps and aggravate racial differences in labor market outcomes. This chapter is not about discrimination. It's about information, which lies at the heart of many discrimination-related problems. Information matters, particularly when we don't have all that we need. Markets tend to favor the party that knows more. Have you ever bought a used car? But if the imbalance or asymmetry of information becomes too large, then markets can break down entirely. This was the fundamental insight of 2001 Nobel laureate George Akerlof, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley. His paper, entitled "The Market for Lemons," used the used car market to make its central point. Any individual selling a used car knows more about its quality than someone looking to buy it. This creates an adverse selection problem, just as it did with the Hope scholarships. Car owners who are happy with their vehicles are less likely to sell them. Thus, used car buyers anticipate hidden problems and demand a discount. But once there's a discount built into the market, owners of high-quality cars become even less likely to sell them, which guarantees the market will be full of lemons. In theory, the market for high-quality used cars will not work, much to the detriment of anyone who may want to buy or sell such a car. In practice, such markets often do work, for reasons explained by the gentleman with whom Mr. Akerlof shared his Nobel Prize. More on that in a moment. The market for lemons is characteristic of the kinds of ideas recognized by the Nobel Committee. It is, in the words of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, a simple but profound and universal idea, with numerous implications and widespread applications. Healthcare, for example, is plagued with information problems. Consumers of healthcare, the patients, almost always have less information about their care than their doctors do. Indeed, even after we see a doctor, we may not know whether we were treated properly. This asymmetry of information is at the heart of our healthcare woes. Under the fee-for-service system, doctors charge a fee for each procedure they perform. Patients do not pay for these extra tests and procedures. Their insurance companies, or the federal government, in the case of older Americans who are eligible for Medicare, do. At the same time, medical technology continues to present all kinds of new medical options, many of which are fabulously expensive. This combination is at the heart of rapidly rising medical costs. Doctors have an incentive to perform expensive medical procedures, and patients have no reason to disagree. If you walk into your doctor's office with a headache, and the doctor suggests a CAT scan, you'd almost certainly agree, just to be sure. Neither you nor your doctor is acting unethically. When cost is not a factor, it makes perfect sense to rule out brain cancer, even when the only symptom is a headache the morning after the holiday office party. Your doctor might also reasonably fear that if she doesn't order a CAT scan, you might sue for big bucks later if something turns out to be wrong with your head. Medical innovation is terrific in some cases and wasteful in others. Consider the current range of treatments for prostate cancer, a cancer that afflicts many older men. One treatment option is watchful waiting, which involves doing nothing unless and until tests show that the cancer is getting worse. This is a reasonable course of action because prostate cancer is so slow-growing that most men die of something else before the prostate cancer becomes a serious problem. Another treatment option is proton radiation therapy, which involves shooting atomic particles at the cancer using a proton accelerator that's roughly the size of a football field. Doing nothing essentially costs nothing, more or less. Shooting protons from an accelerator costs somewhere in the range of $100,000. The cost difference is not surprising. The shocking thing is that proton therapy has not been proven any more effective than watchful waiting. An analysis by the RAND Corporation concluded, no therapy has been shown superior to another. Health maintenance organizations were designed to control costs by changing the incentives. Under many HMO plans, general practitioners are paid a fixed fee per patient per year, regardless of what services they provide. Doctors may be restricted in the kinds of tests and services they can prescribe, and may even be paid a bonus if they refrain from sending their patients to see specialists. That changes things. Now, when you walk into the doctor's office, still at a disadvantage in terms of information about your own health, and say, "I'm dizzy, my head hurts, and I'm bleeding out my ear," the doctor consults the HMO treatment guidelines and tells you to take 2 aspirin. As exaggerated as that example may be, the basic point is valid. The person who knows most about your medical condition may have an economic incentive to deny you care. Complaints about too much spending are replaced by complaints about too little spending. Every HMO customer has a horror story about wrangling with bureaucrats over acceptable expenses. In the most extreme and anecdotal stories, patients are denied life-saving treatments by HMO bean counters. Some doctors are willing to do battle with the insurance companies on behalf of their patients. Others simply break the rules by disguising treatments that are not covered by insurance as treatments that are. Patients aren't the only ones suffering from an asymmetry of information. Politicians have jumped into the fray too, demanding things like disclosure of the incentives paid to doctors by insurance companies and even a patient's bill of rights. The information problem at the heart of healthcare has not gone away. 1. The patient, who does not pay the bill, demands as much care as possible. 2. The doctor maximizes income and minimizes lawsuits by delivering as much care as possible. 3. The insurance company maximizes profits by paying for as little care as possible. 4. Technology has introduced an array of massively expensive options, some of which are miracles and others of which are a waste of money. And 5, it's very costly for either the patient or the insurance company to prove the right course of treatment. In short, information makes healthcare different from the rest of the economy. When you walk into an electronics store to buy a big screen TV, you can observe which picture looks clearest. You then compare price tags, knowing that the bill will arrive at your house eventually. In the end, you weigh the benefits of assorted televisions, whose quality you can observe, against the costs that you'll have to pay, and you pick one. Brain surgery really is different. The fundamental challenge of healthcare reform is paying for the right treatment, the product that makes the most sense relative to what it costs. This is an exercise that consumers perform on their own everywhere else in the economy. Bean counters should not automatically say no to super expensive treatments. Some may be wonderfully effective and worth every penny. They should say no to expensive treatments that are not demonstrably better than less expensive options. They should also say no to doing some tests just to be sure, both because these diagnostics are expensive, but also because when administered to healthy people, they tend to generate false positives, which can breed expensive, unnecessary, and potentially dangerous follow-up care. There's an old aphorism in advertising. I know I'm wasting half my money. I just wish I knew which half. Healthcare is similar. And if the goal of healthcare reform is to restrain rapidly rising costs, then any policy change will have to focus on quality and outcomes rather than just paying for inputs. New York Times financial columnist David Leonhardt describes the treatment for prostate cancer, where fabulously expensive technology does not appear to be delivering better health, as his own personal litmus test for healthcare reform. He writes, "The prostate cancer test will determine whether President Obama and Congress put together a bill that begins to fix the fundamental problem with our medical system, the combination of soaring costs and mediocre results. If they don't, the medical system will remain deeply troubled, no matter what other improvements they make." But we're not done with healthcare yet. The doctor may know more about your health than you do, but you know more about your long-term health than your insurance company does. You may not be able to diagnose rare diseases, but you know whether or not you lead a healthy lifestyle, if certain diseases run in your family, if you're engaging in risky sexual behavior, if you're likely to become pregnant, etc. This information advantage has the potential to wreak havoc on the insurance market. Insurance is about getting the numbers right. Some individuals require virtually no health care. Others may have chronic diseases that require hundreds of thousands of dollars of treatment. The insurance company makes a profit by determining the average cost of treatment for all of its policyholders and then charging slightly more. When Aetna writes a group policy for 20,000 50-year-old men, and the average cost of health care for a 50-year-old man is $1,250 a year, then presumably the company can set the annual premium at $1,300 and make $50, on average, for each policy underwritten. Aetna will make money on some policies and lose money on others, but overall the company will come out ahead if the numbers are right. Is this example starting to look like the Hope scholarships or the used car market? It should. The $1,300 policy is a bad deal for the healthiest 50-year-old men and a very good deal for the overweight smokers with a family history of heart disease. So, the healthiest men are most likely to opt out of the program. The sickest guys are most likely to opt in. As that happens, the population of men on which the original premium was based begins to change. On average, the remaining men are less healthy. The insurance company studies its new pool of middle-aged men and reckons that the annual premium must be raised to $1,800 in order to make a profit. Do you see where this is going? At the new price, more men, the most healthy of the unhealthy, decide that the policy is a bad deal, so they opt out. The sickest guys cling to their policies as tightly as their diseased addled bodies will allow. Once again, the pool changes, and now even $1,800 does not cover the cost of insuring the men who sign up for the program. In theory, this adverse selection could go on until the market for health insurance fails entirely. That does not actually happen. Insurance companies usually insure large groups whose individuals are not allowed to select in or out. If Aetna writes policies for all General Motors employees, for example, then there will be no adverse selection. The policy comes with the job, and all workers, healthy and unhealthy, are covered. They have no choice. Aetna can calculate the average cost of care for this large pool of men and women and then charge a premium sufficient to make a profit. Writing policies for individuals, however, is a much scarier undertaking. Companies rightfully fear that the people who have the most demand for health coverage or life insurance are those who need it most. This will be true no matter how much an insurance company charges for its policies. At any given price, even $5,000 a month, the individuals who expect their medical costs to be higher than the cost of the policy will be the most likely to sign up. Of course, the insurance companies have some tricks of their own, such as refusing coverage to individuals who are sick or likely to become sick in the future. This is often viewed as some kind of cruel and unfair practice perpetrated on the public by the insurance